answer questions. All right, our first principle is to form general impressions about Zechariah as a whole. And as usual, I have formed my 9 general impressions. So it's not you can express appreciation to Zechariah in terms of the letters on the prophet's name. Z-E-C-H-A-R-I-A-A. My first general impression is connected with the letter Z. Zechariah's name. Now notice the word is N-A-M-E-S, not N-A-M-E. Naturally you say, well, are you talking about the double naming of Jews? You know, many Jews in Bible times had double names. For example, you say Saul of Tarsus, Paul, the apostle Gentile. I used to think Saul was his unchristian name and Paul was his Christian name. That isn't the point. Saul was his Jewish name and Paul was his Gentile name. Paulus, meaning little, a little one, that was his Gentile name. And many Jews, both in Old and New Testament times, had more names than one. But I don't think that's the point here. What I have in mind is, right in the very first verse, you're introduced to Zechariah, and it says, Zechariah,
that's pretty all those visions. Who can understand those visions? So you just have a clear introduction right at the beginning. Put them together and see what they get. Jehovah remembers, Jehovah blesses in the appointed time. Now I wonder if you see what all three of these names have in common. The thing they have in common is that all three of them emphasize God's faithfulness. Over them, you can just write Lamentations 3:22, great is thy faithfulness. And now here's how you get that. Iddo's father gave him the name Iddo, the appointed time. And if you figure it back now, you'll see he's at least the grandfather of Zechariah. You may have some generations omitted, but he's at least the grandfather. You see, that takes the way back in the time of the Babylonian captivity. When they're looking forward to the appointed time when God's going to deliver his people. And don't get any use of imagination to realize, remember these Jews were great in the proper name. When somebody said, you know what are you doing? The idea of the appointed time, the kid just be kept before them. Jeremiah, you know, several times said the captivity was going to last 70 years. And then Daniel checked the prophecy and saw that time is just about to come to an end. When God was going to live his people. Well, that was just prominent in the godly realm during captivity. You know, Father just gave him that name, appointed time. God's faithful is going to take you back. And then, Berechiah's father, perhaps Israel, gave him the name Berechiah, Jehovah blesses, just as a reminding fact. Even though God's people were in captivity, God's blessing them, and God blessed them. And then, Zechariah's father, perhaps Berechiah, gave him the name Jehovah remembers. And you see, it isn't some wild use of the imagination to take the significance of these names. I agree with those who think that some commentators just run wild on the significance of proper names. Really, they run wild on them. I don't want to do that, but I don't want to ignore what's actually there. And so that's why we start this difficult-looking book with something very simple. Zechariah's name. Jehovah remembers, Jehovah blesses in the appointed time. Great is thy faithfulness. Great is thy faithfulness. All right, we'll continue. After a break for station identification. We're expressing general impressions about Zechariah as a whole. My first impression connected with the letters the Zechariah's name. And remember, these names had significance in the minds of the Jews. And all these names I mentioned just show you how the truth of God's faithfulness was being claimed by the godly Jews. In other words, this building of the temple wasn't just Haggai's work or Zerubbabel's work or Zechariah's work, but the godly remnant had an awful lot to do with it. Then my second general impression is connected with the letter E. Evangelical vision and prophecy. You know the meaning of the word evangelical. It comes from the Greek word euangelion, which means gospel. And just gospel visions and gospel prophecy. That leads me to emphasize the fact that Zechariah is the most messianic of the minor prophets, just as Isaiah is the most messianic of the major prophets. So Zechariah is the most messianic of the minor prophets. I wonder if you can see any reason why we would naturally expect the messianic note to be unusually strong in these last three books, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Of course, that's what happened, and it's one indication of providential arrangement in the prophet. But the messianic note, looking forward to the first and second coming of Christ, reaches the climax. Why would you naturally expect it? One reason you'd expect it is that these books have to do with the godly remnant that returns to Jerusalem. And you say, for what purpose do they return? For rebuilding the temple, and rebuilding the city, and rebuilding the city wall. Yes, but you see, all that incidental to the main thing. Why did God lead them back? They didn't fully understand all this. But what's the main thing God had in mind in leading them back? The answer is to make special preparation for the coming of Christ. The Lord Jesus was to come and spend his earthly life in the land of Palestine. And the godly remnant didn't understand all this, but God understood it. And we understand it now in retrospect with the whole Bible before us. Well, you see, since God brought the remnant back to make special preparations for the coming of Christ, it's natural to expect an unusual emphasis on the messianic note. And that's what you have. Do you realize that Zechariah is quoted more frequently in the New Testament than any of the minor prophets? You have relatively few quotations from the minor prophets in the New Testament. But you have several outstanding quotations from the book of Zechariah. Zechariah is the only one of the minor prophets to lay stress upon the angel of Jehovah, the second person of the Godhead. You may recall when we studied Pentateuch, we emphasized the five great ways in which Christ appears in the Old Testament. And the interesting thing is that in those five ways in which Christ appears in the Old Testament, Zechariah includes all five of them. That's another evidence of what we call the evangelical emphasis, the gospel emphasis of Zechariah. All five of those ways in which Christ appears in the Old Testament are ways in which he appears in the book of Zechariah. Now, in order to drive this home, let me mention several of the direct prophecies of Christ, which are emphasized in Zechariah. This isn't my broad idea, because in each one of these cases, the New Testament quotes it and shows that it was at least partially fulfilled in the first coming of Christ. One is Zechariah 9:9. Zechariah 9:9 predicts the triumphal entry of Christ. Listen, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just in having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, even upon a colt, the foal of an ass. And the New Testament definitely applies that to the triumphal entry of Christ. Zechariah 11:12-13 prophesies the purchase of the potter's field for 30 pieces of silver. Zechariah 11:12-13, the purchase of the potter's field for 30 pieces of silver. And the New Testament definitely quotes it and applies it to this in the earthly life of Christ. So they weighed for my hire 30 pieces of silver. And Jehovah said unto me, cast it under the potter, the goodly price that I despised that by them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them under the potter in the house of Jehovah. And then the third illustration of it is Zechariah 13:7. Zechariah 13:7 predicts the smiting of the shepherd and the scattering of the sheep. The New Testament quotes it and applies it this way. Listen to Zechariah 13:7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered. I think that's enough
to emphasize this point. Of course, we'll have a lot more of it in our chapter by chapter 7. Evangelical visions and prophecies.
Zechariah is the most messianic of the minor prophets. And you can see one reason you'd expect in these last three books. The godly remnant is back to prepare for the first coming of Christ. And naturally, you would expect a lot about the coming of Christ in these prophecies. My third general impression of Zechariah is connected with the letter C. Quench your
virtues. Virtues is quench the truth and drive it home.
It's another way of saying that Zechariah is unusually devotional. It's filled in a special way with what we call devotional truth. Now I want you to notice the arrangement here. You take the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. The most devotional books of the Pentateuch, filled with quenching verses, is Deuteronomy. It comes right at the end. It's a book of sermons. And then you take the Gospels. I'm studying in one of my other classes here. You have John at the end. Now the others got quenching verses, but John just brings that whole thing to a focus. It's the quenching book. Now again, you've got Zechariah right at the end. And right at the end, you've got a lot of quenching verses. Let me just read this carefully to illustrate my point. The first is what I believe is the most famous verse in Zechariah. What would you say is the most famous verse in Zechariah? Any idea at all? Zechariah 4, verse 6. You all know it. Not by might, finish it for me. Nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. I think that's right to say it's the most famous verse. But, you know, opinions would differ on some of these, but I doubt if they would very much on that. That is a great controversy. And by the way, you notice the context? Now, one thing I want to emphasize in some of these wonderful verses in Zechariah, what we emphasize otherwise, that often the context of a verse is as little known as the verse itself is well known. And I think that's certainly true of this verse. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. How many of you have never heard that verse before? You've heard it. You know the context. You said in this context, you're going to do that sermon. But I think the main point is this. Not my mind nor my power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts, shall what be done? You see, what's Zechariah talking about? What's Haggai talking about? The completion of the temple. The completion of the task. That's what he's saying. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts, shall the temple be completed. Shall the task of God be completed? Then the very next verse, chapter 4, verse 7, is one of my favorites. I claim this over and over again in my daily prayer time. Zechariah 4, 7, who art thou, O great mountain? Now he's talking about the great mountain of difficulty. I think the context is he's taking the great mountain where Jerusalem was built, like Mount Zion where the temple was built. You know, Rome was a city of seven hills. Jerusalem is a city of five hills, five mountains. And one of them is Mount Zion, where the temple is. And he's taking that mountain just as a little reminder of the great difficulties that lay before Zerubbabel in completing the task. And 4:7 says, who art thou, great mountain of difficulty? Before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain. Well, that was a difficulty, all right. 15 years they hadn't completed the job. They quit. And he really had a task before him. You know, the more you've delayed, the harder the thing is God calls you to do. But with all that in the background, they still had it. And then he said, he shall bring forth the top stone. It means complete the task. See, when Zerubbabel got this promise from Zechariah, he didn't think that maybe he'd be able to complete the job. He knew 100% certainty he'd be able to complete the job. To bring forth the cockstone with shoutings of grace, grace, thank you. You see, it's just all of God's grace. Now, we can't pat ourselves on the back and say, look what we did. And because we delayed 15 years. But God saw through. That's one of my favorite verses in the Old Testament. Then chapter 4, verse 10, who hath despised the day of small things? Who hath despised the day of small things? Zechariah 4:10. Then Zechariah 9:12. turn you to the stronghold these prisoners oppose. Isn't that a wonderful expression? Turn you to the stronghold these prisoners oppose. Yeah, they were prisoners. Ah, but prisoners oppose. It's wonderful to be a prisoner if you're a prisoner of hope. That's chapter 9, verse 12. Turn to the stronghold, you prisoners of hope. Chapter 12, verse 10. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. And they shall look unto me whom they fear. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, being bitter for him as one that's bitterness for his firstborn son. I love to claim that first part. I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. And they shall look upon me whom they fear. Well, you say, finally, that will be fulfilled in the second coming. Yeah, but we have present foretaste of that. And I know of no greater verse to claim for revival than that verse. I will pour upon the house of David the spirit of grace and of supplication. And they shall look upon me whom they appear. Then chapter 14, verse 7, it shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light. You know, that's the time when you expect it to be dark. But God saying at the very time when you expect it to be dark, it's going to be light. Oh, that's a great verse, isn't it? Zechariah 14, verse 7, it shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light. That's my third, gentlemen, question, quicker verses. And you see, generally you have this in the different divisions of the Bible. The more you come to the end of a division, the more quicker verses you can find to drive home a particular truth. My first general impression of Zechariah is connected with the letter E, hopeful dreams. Now the prophets in general are great preachers of hope, but in a special way, Zechariah is the prophet of hope. And when I talk about hopeful visions, I remind you that Zechariah is one of the most encouraging books in the Bible. We're going to see later the reason for that. Chapters 1 to 6 contain these eight great visions. And the thing with these eight great visions have in common is they're all visions of hope. They're all visions of encouragement. Hopeful visions. Chapters 1 to 6. I think this is one of the richest sections in Scripture. The first six verses, first six chapters of Zechariah. My sixth general impression of Zechariah is connected with the letter A. Ascetic questions. Now you know what asceticism is. Asceticism has to do with rigid self-denial. And the background of these ascetic questions is in chapters 7 and 8. A man came to Zechariah asking questions about fasting. And the idea was, should we fast? Should we go without food? Now, the background is that during the time of the Babylonian captivity, the Jews had observed four great fasts. The first one came in the fourth month. Second was in the fifth month. Third was in the seventh month. And the fourth was in the tenth month. Now remember that these fasts that they instituted during the time of the Babylonian captivity were not commanded by God in the Old Testament. There was only one fast day commanded by God in the Old Testament. You see, the religion of the Old Testament is not primarily a religion of fasting. It's primarily a religion of feasting rather than fasting. And they just had one fast day commanded by God, and that was the Day of Atonement. Leviticus chapter 16. That's the only one commanded by God. But you see, they instituted these other four. Let me show you why. The one in the fourth month had commemorated the capture of Jerusalem. You see, these five commemorated special efforts in the captivity, in the exile of God's people. The one in the fifth month commemorated the destruction of the temple by fire. And this was the final step, of course, into captivity, and that was the measure of burning the temple. And so the Jews instituted special fasts for that.
because it took place in the 6th month. And then the 7th month commemorated the murder of Gedaliah, the governor. Gedaliah, the governor, was the one who was murdered by the Babylonians. And so they had a special class that is remembered. Then the class that is 10th month recalled the first enclosure of Jerusalem by the enemy line. That is Nebuchadnezzar invaded and his army just enclosed Jerusalem. Now, somebody said, well, but look here then, would this come after this? Would this come before this? Yes, you see, the siege of Jerusalem lasted for a long time, 2 or 3 years I think it was, before it fell. And so quite likely one would come before or after the other. Now that's the background. See, the Jews had instituted those 4 days of fasting, not commanded by God. And so they sent messengers to Zechariah. And the opening of chapter 7 just asked the question, should we fast or not? And through Zechariah, God gave 2 answers to that question, should we keep these fast days? And the first answer was that to obey is better than fasting. To obey is better than fasting. In order to get into the spirit of that, I like to compare chapter 7 and 8 with 1 Samuel 15:22. 1 Samuel 15:22 is Samuel's word to Saul who disobeyed the Lord. 1 Samuel 15:22 says, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. How much better? To obey is how much better than sacrifice. To hearken is so much better. To be infinitely better. The true and unlimited one. And what truly is true of obedience and fasting. To obey is better than fasting. Infinitely bad. Now, one reason this passage in Zechariah 7 and 8 is so practical today is that it sheds light on a practical question. Should a Christian keep Lent? Now, you know what Lent is. Lent just means spring. It comes in the spring of the year. And the word Easter also means spring. And there are ritualistic churches, especially like the Catholic and the Episcopalian, I think some Lutherans have it also, that have this time 40 days of fasting before Easter. It begins with what they call Ash Wednesday, and then that inaugurates Easter season. The question is this, should a Christian keep Lent? Dr. McCookin rather surprised me some years ago. He certainly wasn't from one of the ritualistic churches, but he said, I don't take an absolute stand against Lent. He said, I believe that Lent can be a blessing to a devout Episcopalian. And I believe in some cases it has been a blessing. But although he said he wouldn't be against it emphatically, yet he'd be against an awful lot connected with it. And how does he answer that? Should you keep Lent or not? Here's an answer. See, Lent is a kind of fasting that's not commanded by God. Just as these hearers coming from the captivity were fast, not commanded by God. Here's the first basic answer. To obey is infinitely better than fasting. It doesn't solve everything, but it gets you started in the right direction. For example, how many times have you heard the Episcopalian make a statement like this? You know, I just hate Lent. I sure will be glad when Lent's over. What would you tell him? I'd say, buddy, don't you keep Lent. If that's your attitude. Because what you need to do is to learn how to obey the Lord, and to obey the Lord is infinitely better than fasting. Because you know where we get the idea of martyr's law. You know what martyr's law means. When we think of martyr's law, we just think of it in terms of New Orleans. Because they have the big martyr's law festival there where all the Roman Catholics are. But martyr's law just means Fat Tuesday. See, gras is Greek, fat, and martyr is Tuesday. What happens is Ash Wednesday officially begins Lent, and they've got to have one final flurry. And brother, the sky's the limit in that Mardi Gras. And of course, we think of that in terms of New Orleans, but you really have Mardi Gras over the Roman Catholic world. And Miss McClarty, the teacher from the Bible College, spoke Spanish and all, and she told me some details, and she said some of those Catholic countries And they just heal it so that they have another Mardi Gras about the middle of it. See? Well, should you fast like that? Oh, the answer is, to obey is infinitely better than fasting. That's the first answer. See, it doesn't solve everything, but it starts in the right direction. And then you think, well, God isn't glorified just because of the fact you don't eat the necessary food. Then the second answer was that the fasting season would become cheerful season because the Jews would be a universal blessing. There you see is where Zechariah gives more and more the prophetic outlook. Why fast? Well, a lot of you who fast, they're just fasting through great sorrow, but fasting season will become cheerful season because the Jews will be a universal blessing. Those are the two great answers that these chapters give to the question about fasting. That's my fifth general question, ascetic question. Questions about asceticism. Questions about fasting. Then my sixth general question of Zechariah is connected with the letter R.
Restoring breath. Restoring breath. One of the outstanding features of Zechariah is the two great prophecies which it contains concerning Christ as the bride. Now in a moment I'm going to outline some of these references for you, Christ as the bride.
But before I do, I want you to get the main point. See, why does Zechariah call Christ the bride? Zechariah contains many prophecies of restoration. And one thing is this, how is that restoration going to be effective? How is it going to be brought about? And the answer is, restoration is going to be effected through the branch. Now you see, the branch, Christ is called. In other prophets, branch is also used for the godly remnant. You see, the point is, the godly remnant is the branch that is true to the Lord when all these other dead branches have to be chopped off because of sin and unfaithfulness. But how is all this restoration blessing going to be brought to God's people? The answer is through that faithful branch. And so you can see how that's a wonderful prophecy of Christ. The faithful branch of the tree will be used to bring blessing to the whole tree. The whole tree is the nation of Israel. And an awful lot of these branches have been unfaithful have to be chopped off. But how is the nation going to be blessed? Through the branch. So that's the point of these passages. The faithful branch will bring blessing to the whole tree. Now, attention has often been called to the fact that four of the Old Testament prophecies concerning Christ as the branch correspond with the four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We'll give you another note that in this study. Matthew presents Christ as the king. Mark presents Christ as the servant. Luke presents Christ as the man. And John presents Christ as the mighty God. And the interesting thing is that in these passages that I'm going to give you, one context calls Christ the branch as the king. One calls him the branch as the servant. One the branch is man and one the branch is God. Let me give you the definite references. Jeremiah 23:5 corresponds to Matthew's presentation. Jeremiah 23:5 says, "Behold, the day comes, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king." You see, there's Matthew's point. Christ as king, the branch. And then Mark presents him as the servant. Zechariah 3:8 corresponds to Mark's presentation. Zechariah 3:8 says, "Behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch." He just says it in so many words. Then Luke presents him as man. And Zechariah 6:12 corresponds to Luke. "Behold, the man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up out of his place and build the temple of Jehovah."
that John possessed Christ as the mighty God. That corresponds to Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6.
Behold, the day comes, says Jehovah, that I will lay him unto David the righteous one. And this is his name whereby he shall be called Jehovah Tsidkenu, Hebrew, Jehovah our righteousness. Now, you see how the four gospels are related to these prophecies concerning Christ as the branch. They show why we can expect such wonderful things to be accomplished through the branch. Why can we expect such wonderful things to be accomplished? Because the branch is king. The branch is servant. The branch is man. The branch is God. And I think the comparison here is just a wonderful illustration of what we mean when we say the Old Testament gives the truth in seed form, and the New Testament gives it in fully developed form. And in prophecy, you just have these things in seed form, and then in the Gospels, they're developed in fully developed form. That's my fifth general impression, the restoring branch. And don't forget, one distinctive feature of Zechariah is these two great prophecies of Christ as the branch. How will blessing come to the whole tree? Through the faithful branch. And you say the faithful branch is the godly remnant. Yes, but the very center of the godly remnant is Christ himself. My seventh general question of Zechariah is connected with the letter I. Increase comes of interpretation. Increased problems of interpretation. What I mean to say is that Zechariah is by far the most difficult of the minor prophets to interpret. And you see, one reason why it's by far the most difficult is because it's filled with symbolical visions and symbolical prophecies. And of course, you've got to go in great detail into the symbol to get the meaning of the symbol and then how the symbol applies. In other words, when you're right at the end of the Old Testament, you're in one of your most difficult books of the Old Testament scripture. Now, in this connection, I want to mention something which I found to be true throughout the years. The special problems lead to special blessings. Special problems lead to special blessings. Now, this is true in Bible study, and it's also true in life. Remember, students, you study the Bible pretty much the way you live. Why is it so serious for a person just to be mechanical in the way he studies the Bible? Because if he's mechanical in the way he studies the Bible, that's the way he lives. I study the Bible the way I live. You study the Bible the way you live. One of the students here at school said something to me some time ago that I thought was very precious. He said, when I came here to school, I was planning to study the Bible in a mechanical kind of way. But he said, I found out here at school that Bible study includes all of life. And all of that. Includes all of life. Special problems lead to special blessings. True in Bible study, true in life. One thing I'm emphasizing in this context is whenever you come up against special problems of Bible interpretation, just expect special blessings to come to you if you don't just wave your hand and pass over them. Because special problems lead to special blessings. That's my seventh general impression, increased problems of interpretation. I believe I'm accurate when I say that Zechariah is by far the most difficult of the minor prophets to interpret. My eighth general impression of Zechariah is connected with the letter A. Amazing prophecy. Could you serve it out for me? Amazing prophecies of what? That we haven't really touched on yet. Now, we've had evangelical vision concerning Christ. But here's one specific aspect of it. Amazing prophecies of what? Of the second coming. You see, he takes you right on to the time of the end. I want to give you just two illustrations of this. One of the most unique prophecies of the second coming is Zechariah 14:4. We use this to illustrate something right at the beginning of the semester. But listen to it again. As far as I know, this
prophecy is without parallel in either the Old or New Testament. There's nothing as explicit as this. Zechariah 13:4, just takes your breath away when you get the meaning of it. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be cleft in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley. And half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. Incidentally, Zechariah is a great passage in favor of the premillennial approach to eschatology. It's very difficult to try to spiritualize something like this. How would you spiritualize that? His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, and will be cleft asunder, and there will be a very great valley, a mighty miracle of God. I don't think there's any complete parallel to Zechariah 14:4, either in the Old Testament or in the New Testament. Then another unique prophecy which has not been fulfilled is Zechariah 8:23. Zechariah 8:23 says, "Thus says Jehovah Host, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the language of the nations. They shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, We will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you." In other words, what this amazing prophecy, Zechariah 8:23, is saying is that 10 times the number of Jews will want to be Jews. But you know that hasn't been fulfilled yet. That certainly hasn't been fulfilled yet. That's going to happen in connection with the second coming of Christ. You won't know the face now, but just suppose you go to some big city and just ask a lot of people at random whom you see, knowing that they're not Jews. Just ask them, do you wish you were Jews? Well, the general answer would certainly be no, and I'm afraid you'd get a good many insulting answers to that if you'd ask that question, do you wish you were Jews? But this passage is saying that when Jesus comes again, 10 times the number of Jews will wish they were Jews. Again, it's awfully hard for me to see how amillennialism or postmillennialism could explain a passage like that. All right, that's my eighth general impression, amazing prophecies of the second coming. And then my ninth general impression is Zechariah is connected with the letter 8. I'll give you part of it and see if you can spell out the missing word. Ending. How does it end? Giving an 8 there to show the ending of the book. Now, you think I'm going to use the word happy? What? Hallelujah. Hallelujah ending, yeah? It's Hallelujah ending, it sure is, but it's a happy ending. But it's happy because it's something else. We say that all the minor prophets but 2 have this glorious triumphant ending. But here's the special thing about Zechariah that I don't want you to forget. What word beginning with 8 would you give? In God's way of looking at things, happiness is not the goal, it's the byproduct. The goal is what? Holiness, and I just call it a holy ending. And the fact is, the word holiness is used right at the end of the book. For example, let me give you the next to the last verse of Zechariah, and then I'll give you the last verse of Zechariah. Here's the next to the last verse, chapter 14, verse 20. Zechariah 14, 20 says, "In that day there shall be upon the bells of the horses, holy unto Jehovah." This is capitalized in our version. "From the bells of the horses, holy unto Jehovah." What's the idea of that? The bells of the horses, they'll have holy unto Jehovah. "And the pots of Jehovah's house shall be like the bowls before the altar." In order to get into the meaning of that, I like to compare Zechariah 14, 20 with Exodus 28, 36 to 38. And if you read Exodus 28, 36 to 38, you'll find these words talking about the garments of the Jewish priests. And it says, "Thou shalt make a plate of pure gold and grave upon it like the engravings of a signet, holy to Jehovah." See, those words, holy to Jehovah, were written on the garment of priests. All right, hold that for a moment. And then comes to Zechariah 14, 20. And it says, "Upon the bells of the horses shall be the word, holy unto Jehovah."
think the simple idea is this, it's just a strong way of saying that everything will be whole. Even the bells of the horses are going to have those words, holy unto Jehovah, written upon them. You see, that's the way Zechariah ends up. Holy ending. You say a happy ending, yeah, but happiness is the goal. Holiness is the goal. Happiness is the byproduct. Now that's the next to the last verse. Now let me illustrate through the last verse. And let me see if you can complete this for me, supply the missing word. By the way, some of these Bible readings are good. You just check up on your Bible facts. Here's one type of question that says, supply the missing word. You don't like that very much when I give it to you on exam. You've got to be graded on it, but it could be a lot of fun when you aren't going to be graded on it. Zechariah 14:21. And in that day there shall be no more a what? In the house of Jehovah's host. That's the way Zechariah put it. When you think it is. In that day there should be, that's it. In that day there should be no more a Canaanite in the house of Jehovah. And of course he's using the word Canaanite here in the sense of an unholy person. I like to contrast this with Matthew 21:13. Matthew 21:13, Jesus cleansed the temple and he said, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but ye make it a den of robbers. I believe he read Peter. King James says, then Ephesians. But you see, the Greek word is stronger than Ephesians. Ephesians is one who just steals in quietly and then steals out, having done his dirty work. But a robber is more open. The word robber is even stronger. He says, you make it a den of robbers. When Christ came to earth the first time, was the house of God a pure house? Anything but. Anything but. But Zechariah is looking on to the future, and he's saying, there shall be no more of Canaanite in the house of Jehovah of hosts. And that's the end of it. I think it's interesting to realize that this title, Jehovah of hosts, which I told you means the Lord of all the armies of heaven and earth, occurs 14 times in Haggai, and it occurs more than 50 times in Zechariah, the Lord of all the armies of heaven and earth. And that's the way Zechariah closes, and that's the way Haggai closes. The last words of Haggai are Jehovah Host, the Lord of all the armies of heaven and earth. The last words of Zechariah are the same, Jehovah Host, the Lord of all the armies of heaven and earth. Isn't that a wonderful way to close? With your eyes fixed on Jehovah Host. Now I want to tell you, if your eyes are fixed on Jehovah Host, then you're going to build a temple. If my eyes are fixed on Jehovah Host, then I'm going to build a temple. All right, those are my nine general places for Zechariah. Zechariah's name, evangelical vision, prophet, quencher verses, hopeful vision, ascetic questions, restoring breath, increased providence interpretation, amazing prophecy of the second coming. I didn't write that out. Amazing prophecy of the second coming. And then the holy end. That's the way the book is closed. Yes.
Yeah, the
the only fast day commanded by God in the Old Testament was the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16.
That's a very good job.
Then they instituted these other days that I had written on the board a few moments ago. Especially, what about this? And you can see how the answers to those questions just throw you right in line with ritualistic churches today, and then with the whole question of fasting. To what degree should you call for a day of fasting and prayer, and that sort of thing? Well, God doesn't stop every detail, but he gives the thrust in the right direction. The Christian religion, the religion of the Bible, is not primarily religion of fasting. It's primarily teaching. And to obey is infinitely better than fasting. Any questions or comments thus far? On page 133, we come to our second principle, seek to get a bird's eye view of the book of Zechariah as a whole. State and discuss what you believe to be the central message of the book. As preparation for stating the theme of Zechariah, if you look at the three slides, state again the central message of Haggai. Don't try to copy it down. But I want to give it to you, and then just be prepared for Zechariah and see what words you've changed here who's changing the central message. Here's the central message of Haggai as we say it. Deliverance by Jehovah of Hosts. You see that title, Jehovah of Hosts. Very important in these restoration books. Deliverance by Jehovah of Hosts from the half-heartedness that causes an incomplete temple. All right, now here's the central message of Zechariah. Deliverance by Jehovah of Hosts. Again, great testament. See if you remember. How many times does that title occur in Haggai in the two chapters? 14 times. How many times in Zechariah does it occur, Jehovah of Hosts? More than 50. More than 50 times. Delivered by Jehovah of Hosts from the plot that causes an incomplete temple. Now in Haggai, it's delivered by Jehovah of Hosts from the half-heartedness that causes an incomplete temple. Now, in Zechariah, it's delivered by Jehovah of Hosts from the plot that causes an incomplete temple. It's somewhat the same, and yet it's much more specific than just one side of it. What is it? What was causing the incomplete temple, according to Zechariah? What? Incomplete vision? Yes, I think that's a good way to state it. I've got just a simpler word than that. It's one we use ordinary in everyday life. And when you use that word, I think it helps to barb in your soul what Zechariah is saying. What causes a person, what's the main hindrance is to completing the job? Half-heartedness? Haggai. Now one special aspect of half-heartedness. Just the word discouragement. From the discouragement that causes an incomplete temple. Why does the devil just love to get you discouraged? Because you're not going to complete the task God calls you to complete if you get discouraged. I'm not going to complete the task God has called me to complete if I get discouraged. According to the book of Zechariah, how does God deliver his people from discouragement? Can you tell me? How does he deliver his people from discouragement? And I believe the great answer is that not by giving a pat on the back. You see, that's man's way of deliverance from discouragement. And I tell you, an awful lot of Christians have picked up the world's way of overcoming discouragement. All that fellow just leaves a pat on the back. Everybody pat him on the back and encourage him. And I want to tell you, sometimes you can give him a pat on the back when he needs to be patted down low enough and hard enough to do some good, as the preacher says. And, you know, you can work at cross purposes with God. Have you ever had anybody do that? When really you were down and people came and patted you on the back and tried to encourage you, and really what you need was conviction. They worked at cross purposes with God, and it just sort of helped to nullify what God was seeking to do. No, God doesn't deliver his people from discouragement by giving the pat on the back, but by revealing his glory. That's the great answer. By revealing God's glory, he delivers from discouragement. If you check the book on systematic theology, you'll find that the average theologian lists approximately 12 of what he calls the major attributes of God. And if you check the 12 major attributes of God in the average book of theology, you won't find that any theologian includes glory as one of God's attributes. You say, well, God is glorious. That's one of his attributes. No. If you think it too carefully, you'll see that the glory of God is not one of his attributes. It's the sum total of all his attributes. For example, God is omnipotent. And what relation does God's glory have to his omnipotence? You see, God is glorious in his omnipotence. God is omniscient. His omniscience is a glorious omniscience. God is infinite. God is glorious in his infinity. And if you want a blessing, you just sit down sometime and meditate on that. One reason I emphasize it is to drive home again a good verse from Exodus that helps to quench Zechariah right at the beginning. It's Exodus 33:18. You know what it is? I often repeat it. Show me, I pray thee, thy glory. Show me, I pray thee, thy glory. Now you see, when you need to pray that, you're having a whole course in theology burned into your soul. Glory is just one of God's attributes. It's the sum total of all God's attributes. In other words, just take it apart and pray it like this. Show me, I pray thee, thy glory. Show me, I pray thee, thy glory. omnipotence? Show me, I pray you, thy glorious omniscience. Show me, I pray you, thy glorious omnipresence. Show me, I pray you, thy glorious infinity. Show me, I pray you, thy glorious eternity. Show me, I pray you, thy glorious love. Show me, I pray you, thy glorious holiness. Show me, I pray you, thy glorious justice. You see, that one prayer is just a closure of everything that God is. That's one reason I love it. How many of you have used that prayer right just there? Show me, I pray, thy glory. Got to see your hand? Oh, folks, it's a tremendous heaven. And it's the key to entering into the whole message of Zechariah. What's the thing that causes an incomplete temple? The answer is discouragement. What's the cure for discouragement? It's a vision of the glory of Jehovah Christ. I want to tell you something. At any moment when my eyes are fixed upon the glory of the Lord, it is 100% impossible for me to be discouraged. Somebody say, it's just impossible for me to have deliverance to be discouraged. No other way around. At any moment when my eyes are fixed on the glory of the Lord, it's absolutely impossible for me to be discouraged. And one thing I love about Zechariah, as I'll show you later, is he doesn't chop off weeds on the surface. He just tries to chop down the back a little bit. But he gets right down underneath the whole thing. That's the basic message of Zechariah. Let me repeat it before I give the diagram. Deliverance by the Holy Ghost from the service that causes an incomplete temple. Here's the diagram for Zechariah. You'll recall that in Haggai, a basic diagram was a front.